You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
Oh, yeah. The show is like mother, like son?
Yes. That's right, with
really?
A question mark.
With a question mark.
You know, it's a mother-son thing.
Ramsey, this is more important than something else coming my way today.
Okay.
To change it. You want to be a richer man.
You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio JFF. This is my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
We're in the studio with our producer, Mark Sutton.
All right. Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son. And tonight we're talking to Bartle Bull, whose new novel, China Star, is his fifth novel, which is set, like his others, in the past colonial world. And it's filled with adventure and intrigue and many other things exotic. But, Bartle, before we start talking about your books, because this is a Like Mother, Like Son program,
right.
I'd like to hear about Like Father, Like Son. You're very much like your father, and I think your father influenced your writing. And you have a son who's clearly influenced by you, and there's a real father-son father.
Yes, there has been a chain of, I think inspiration is too generous a word, but a chain of influence, one might say. My own English grandfather was a great friend of writer Haggard, who wrote the first great African novel, King Solomon's Mines.
Oh, right.
And I was brought up, you know, hearing writer Haggard stories, and writer Haggard's great book, King Solomon's Mines, you know, was a favorite book of Winston Churchill and Teddy Roosevelt. And I read it as a young boy, and that helped me get interested in Africa. And since then, I've written three novels about Africa.
And you took your son on a safari there, right?
Yes, yes. When he was about, I think, 11 or 12, I took him on his first safari in what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. And we had wonderful adventures on the Zambezi River, the canoe turning over in the midst of, you know, hippos and stuff, and all kinds of wonderful things. And it really got him started as well on this kind of travel.
And your first novel, your first fiction was, I mean, you wrote a book about an African safari, but
correct.
Then you also wrote a novel about Africa. And why did you decide to switch over to fiction?
Well, I had done this first history book, which was the history of the African safari from 1830 until today. And I did that because I felt these old hunters were sort of dying off and people were losing their diaries and their photographs. And I wanted to put that whole history together. And then in doing that, I thought it was such a marvelous subject for fiction, that whole period of the early, you know, the early African colonial safari period and all that. And plus, I had been to Africa several times. I wrote my thesis at Harvard on the history of Rhodesia, and I had gone to Kenya in 1959 in the course of doing that. And so I had this old background with Kenya. And so my first novel was set in Kenya in 1919 and 1920, just after the First World War.
And that novel was the White Rhino Hotel.
That was the White Rhino Hotel, yes.
And then it was followed by Cafe on the Nile.
Yes, and that was followed by Cafe on the Nile, which was set in Ethiopia and in Cairo in 1935, 1936. And as you know, that was the time when Mussolini and the Italians invaded Ethiopia. And so my characters were on safari there, and they got sort of chased across Ethiopia. And I went across the Ethiopia myself, you know, on the same route that my characters took down towards the Kenya border all the way from Addis Ababa. And, I tried to do the same things my characters do without quite as much violence.
Right.
So that's why I went there at that time.
Well, I want to ask you about that, the kind of research that you've done for your novels. I mean, it's exciting to think that you were in Africa and physically there, but you also had to spend a lot of time reading microsheaf
yes,
newspaper
that's right.
clippings. And just give us a sense of how much time you spend
What's
to really research. That's the old-fashioned way of doing
well,
research.
Well, that's really why I spend about 3 years on each book, because I probably spend a year and a half roughly doing my homework of different kinds. I've learned that the best way to get a real taste for what daily life was like in these places like Nairobi and Cairo and Shanghai is to read the English language daily newspaper of the time. And normally you can only get those these days on microfilm, and they're scattered around usually different universities. And I normally read, for example, I read 3 years of the East African Standard, that's the Nairobi newspaper, from 1919 to 1921 on the full sheet old newspapers in London. And then in the
and
case
you really
of,
went there every day and read what the first the
I went
page.
To the, I went to the library. Well, these newspapers usually are only about 8 or 12 or 16 pages long, these colonial, you know, period newspapers.
Right.
And in some of these old English libraries, they occasionally have them, and they're all, you know, bound. And I would go there every day. It was three subway rides from central London out to the edge of London to this old library. And then I would also, after that, go back to Nairobi. I would talk to all these old-timers. I would read a lot of old diaries and a lot of books. So I try to do, you know, all that. But the newspaper really gives you that taste for, you know, the restaurants and the crimes and the troubles the farmers had and how life really worked day to day.
Yeah, you really do fill in with very specific everyday incidents, which makes it very real. Also, I mean, you don't really celebrate, but in a way you do the sort of colonial era and that time of life in the world. And I think you have an interesting take on that when you've been asked about it.
Well, yes, I do have an interesting take on it, I think, or at least I have my own take on it. But really, it's a very complicated subject, colonialism. I mean, it was very different in places like the Belgian Congo. It was a terrible, terrible thing. In places like Kenya, where there never really was black-white conflict, it was not really a terrible thing. I mean, it developed the country in a pretty healthy way. And it varied enormously. I think the Belgians and the Portuguese really were the worst at it. And the Brits may have been the best. But it varies a lot. And it does add a whole layer to the world, you know.
I once had a professor, Connor Cruz O'Brien.
Oh, yes.
His theory was the French, the England, different countries had different ways of influence in a country. And some were, in fact, much better than others.
Oh, absolutely.
Bartle, tell me a little bit about your attitude and art of the novel. I mean, how have you interpreted it in your writing in the sense that, you know, you're not doing science fiction, are you?
No, I'm not doing science fiction. I'm doing historical novels, and I believe in having a meticulous background, both historically and physically and socially, and then I invent the story and the characters and, you know, dig them into that or bury them in that background. But I enjoy two things in approaching it that way. One is I like both the scholarship of doing the homework of the history and all that, and the other is I like the adventure it gives me personally because I always go to these places. So I combine a sort of fairly adventurous trip myself or trips with a lot of academic homework. So that, for example, in the case of China Star, my latest novel, which is partly set in Sri Lanka, Ceylon at the time of the novel, of course, 1922. I spent a couple of months there, and I left on Christmas Day, the day before the tsunami, and had a wonderful, interesting time, and then was so upset, you know, at the tragedy that followed. But, I left just one day before that.
That's amazing.
So, Bartle, you published your first book in 1988, is that right?
Was that my first novel or my first? I think that was yes,
Safari.
That was my first book. That was Safari, A Chronicle of Adventure. Yes, sir.
I sort of witnessed the transformation of technology, firsthand through college.
Sure.
The internet was invented, you know, or my
yeah.
last year of college was the last year that the University of Wisconsin didn't have the internet.
Oh, really?
And I'm curious, did you write Safari on a typewriter?
I really started Safari longhand because I started it really when I was traveling around, you know, all those countries where the great safaris took place, like South Africa and Zambia and Zimbabwe and Botswana and so on. So I would take an enormous amount of notes, and I'd try to, you know, write a rough start the chapters. But no, I when I got back, I did try to type into, a new Apple computer, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. And now it is.
And I begin my writing, the way I work really is that I start every morning around 7 days a week, probably including Christmas. And I usually go to a diner or have a cup of coffee somewhere, and I edit my 2 or 3 pages the previous day, over the coffee, and then I go back to my computer and I put those changes in, and that gets me writing the next page and so on.
And I want to talk a little bit about China Star because it is your most recent book, and it starts out, it's actually a sequel, right,
yes,
to
yes.
Shanghai Station,
yes.
with sort of a scene of white Russians, and you're immediately set back in a kind of other era, other
That's
time.
The idea.
And then the two main, well, they're not really the main characters, but Katya and Alexander. But I want to talk about, without giving too much away about the novel, because it really is just crammed full of excitement, but how did you develop such a venal villain, this guy Viktor Polyak, or how do you
Polyak.
Say
Polyak. Well, I've done a lot of homework on on the dark days of Soviet communism, and they did have this tradition, which goes on right through from Trotsky when they murdered him with a ice pick, you know, in Mexico.
Right.
Right to last week when they the KGB, almost certainly, well, the KGB successor poisoned that guy in London.
You're right.
And this is a very old tradition of the Soviets following their enemies around the world and hunting and killing them. So it wasn't unplausible to have my villain be a Soviet commissar working for the Comintern, which was a communist international, as you know.
Right.
And they sent people abroad to kill their enemies. I mean, I knew a man who was a Russian defector who was killed that way in the 50s, in New York, actually, in the city here.
You mean the same way that your character was killed?
No one died the way my character was killed. I like to think he has a very original death.
Where did you get that? It was amazing.
Well, he...
Do you mind if we say what it was?
Not at all, but it took three ways to kill him, you know, the same way...
Right, it was like Rasputin.
Yes, exactly, just like Rasputin, who it took, you know, they had to poison him, club him, shoot him, and finally drown him. But,
right.
But in the case of my guy, he is poisoned first by a wonderful Chinese device called a bamboo pill, which the Chinese used during World War II occasionally when they were in Japanese prison camps, and they were usually used as cooks by the Japanese. And they would take a sliver of bamboo, wind it into a tight ball, and harden it inside some sort of rice flour so it dried hard. Then they'd put that in the food. The Japanese soldier would swallow that, you know, in the course of a long line of soldiers eating out of a big pot. The bamboo would uncoil in his stomach, and he'd bleed to death, you know, over the next 3 days, probably far away from where he ate this thing.
It's pretty grim.
So I used that. It's very hard to find. I was told when I began to write fiction, the two things it's hard to do in an original way. One is a sex scene, and the other is death and murder, because, you know, there are thousands of books describing repetitively, you know, various ways of doing that.
Right.
So I tried to give my villain a different death.
Well, I must say, by the end of the novel, you wanted him to have a bad death. Even the snakeheads. Now, were they some kind of fish?
Yes, that's a real fish called a snakehead, and the bad news is that they have migrated from China. And some of them apparently were released in Maryland near Chesapeake Bay, and there are complaints now about snakeheads down there. This is a kind of fish which has a head like a long dragon or snake and a very long jaw and sort of saw teeth. And if it's in a pool, it'll eat everything. You know, it'll grab the leg of a duck and slowly eat the duck. It will, and if the pool is empty of water or food, it will slither for up to a kilometer or two across land to find new water. And it'll eat anything. I mean, they eat their young. The male will often eat the females unless they're nearly as big as he is. I mean, they're wonderfully vicious fish. And so I have this villain who has a couple of these in his very large goldfish bowls.
This is a little sort of like 007, I
James
think.
Bond.
It all comes together. it's a great adventure story.
Well, Bartle, you yourself, it's not like you've just been a writer and traveler your whole life. You were a lawyer and a publisher and a lot of different things. The Village Voice, you have a connection to.
I was a publisher of The Village Voice for quite a few years, and I have had a checkered career. I mean, I'm now being dragged back into one of my other careers, which is politics.
You must be happy after the last election.
Well, it's not altogether, but you know, in '68 I was Bobby Kennedy's New York campaign manager,
right?
And I'm right now getting into hope to get into the start of the Giuliani campaign, which I hope is coming up. He's the only Republican I've really favored, and I think he's a terrific.
Well, I think that there's a new movie coming out, Bobby, starring Lindsay Lohan. I bet you're excited about that.
I went to the premiere screening of the new movie Bobby 2.5 weeks ago here in New York.
Right.
And to my horror, but then they had a big dinner for 250 people, and to my amazement, Harvey Weinstein, who I don't know, who's this wonderful producer, he came up to me and said, "Would I get up and speak at the end of the dinner?" Which was about 30 seconds later, about Bobby Kennedy, which I did. I mean, I didn't have much choice. I did, but it was a very powerful evening. I cried during the movie, but much of it is nonsense. It's got a lot of soap opera stuff in it. But it also has very powerful old scenes of 1968.
Yeah, you were also, just to back up a little bit from '68. You were with the active in the civil rights movement, and you spent time in Mississippi.
Yeah, I was arrested in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in fact, and sort of shot at. Or at least I was in some nasty scenes down there, and I got arrested and brought a couple of lawsuits. Had a very interesting time. It was very much like Mississippi Burning. That film was very true to life, and in fact, some of the stuff I saw was actually worse than that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. There was one other thing about that sort of era that's now coming back into public interest is Edie Sedgwick.
Yes, I've noticed that. An old girlfriend of mine.
Well, yeah, I think there's going to be a movie, or has been a movie about
her. There's about to be a movie. Yes, there is. It's about to. I think it's going to be out pretty soon.
Do you have any comments about Edie?
No, because I haven't been involved in it. I'm just as pleased as I wasn't. But I was very fond of Edie. I took her out for about a year when I was at Harvard Law School, before she came to New York, and then here she fell into the corrupt hands of the Warhol gang and got in all kinds of trouble, with drugs and stuff, and finally committed suicide. But it was very sad. I was very touched one day. One of her brothers said I was the only person who had ever been nice to her, but I hope that wasn't true. She was a marvelous, talented girl, but very vulnerable.
Right. No, that seems true from what the history of what happened to her.
Yeah.
One last thing about that era, and then we may move on more to the political situation today. But I know you were also, and this is interesting, the Bedford-Stuyvesant probe effort.
Oh, yes.
That nobody knows about anymore.
Well, in fact, it's funny you say that, because I've just written an article, which may be in the Daily News here in New York this Sunday or Monday, in which I say how much alike Bobby Kennedy and Rudy Giuliani were and are, in my opinion. And one of the things I say in this article, which will be out this weekend, I think, is that the way I got to know them both and saw their good qualities was in Bed-Stuy, because I was a young volunteer lawyer working for Bobby Kennedy in Bed-Stuyvesant before he ran for president. Of course, that was the biggest slum in New York, bigger than Harlem in Brooklyn. And I saw how intense and devoted he was to improving Bed-Stuy and doing it really without public money, with support from the local black community, with major investment from big white corporations, which he would bully to invest there, and also with a lot of philanthropy. That combination, people like myself as a volunteer lawyer, helping young blacks start a business like opening a gas station, And then I hadn't been there for 33 years until after Bobby's death. I hadn't been back to Bed-Stuy. And then when I worked in Giuliani's campaign for the Senate against Hillary Clinton, I went with him one day to Bed-Stuy, where he was having one of his monthly, never mentioned in the press, one of his monthly community meetings. And this was in a black high school in Bed-Stuy. There must have been 1,500 people in the gymnasium. And Giuliani's on a folding chair with all of his commissioners, and they hated this, on chairs facing the crowd. And they would ask, this went for 2 hours, they would ask, Rudy very tough questions, and he would answer and then make the appropriate commissioner answer and say, "And I want a report from you in the next 48 hours. The commissioners hated it, but Rudy, in fact, got on very, very well with the community, and I began to realize he was getting a bad rap from the New York Times, etc., because he was doing this kind of thing very, very well. He was totally at home with them. So I began to see that they had a lot of similarities, and that's one reason I'm going to be, I hope to work for Rudy if he runs again this time.
So he's going to be your candidate.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm not a Hillary fan, but I didn't answer one of your earlier questions. May I do that, which was about my son?
Yes, I wanted to make sure we at least ended up with that, but I'd like to hear about what Bartle's up to right now.
Well, he's in Iran as we speak this evening, and
he had an op-ed piece in the New York Times, right?
Oh, he broke the rule of not being able to have one by the same person more than 6 months apart. I mean, he's written, I think, three or four for the New York Times, and also for the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the London Telegraph and Times, and many other papers. He spent about 9 months in Iraq in the last 2 years, and three trips to Iran. And he was in Damascus when they burned down those two embassies, and he spent last Christmas in Beirut. And anyway, he's now writing a book on Mesopotamia, which, as you know, means the land between the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates.
Right.
And it's going to be called Paradise Lost: The Power of History in the Fertile Crescent. It should be out in about a year. But he's in Iran right now doing homework for that. And so I was really quite amused today when I learned that I would have a piece in the Daily News, this weekend, and was also writing a book. And he had a piece last week in the Financial Times on Iraq, and he's also writing a book, although he's, 6,000 miles away.
Well, you are like father, like son.
well, he writes better than I do, and he's also much nicer.
Oh, okay.
But, I got a question about the spirit of adventure, which is, just so apparent. Well, clearly your son has it too, but, in talking with you. It strikes me because I really feel that the way this technology has evolved and American culture has evolved, there's a lot less of that spirit of adventure. Or maybe it's just manifested differently with the younger generation. People are online. They're building worlds in fantasy lands, and their sense of adventure is so different. And I'm not quite sure why it's happened like that. But
yes, that's a good question.
What is your take? You are clearly adventure is what keeps your blood moving, right?
Yes, it does, really. But I think it's like, it's not something you can really give to another person, to a child. All these things we've been talking about, like literacy or moral energy or adventure, that spirit and so on, you can open doors for kids, as you know, but they have to go through the door and want to do it and carry on. I took my son on our first really adventurous trip when he was eight, down to the Andes, and we spent Easter night in a shepherd's hut up in the mountains next to a bank of snow, and then the next day rode down the mountain, And he was eight, and we had a pretty rough ride down. He had a nasty fall, in fact. But ever since he was eight, which was the time that his parents got divorced, that I got divorced, every year I would take him somewhere on an adventurous horseback trip. And there's no question that you can stimulate the spirit of adventure, but some people just don't take to it, whereas my son just, took to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in due course he became the youngest member in history of the Explorers Club and was the first person in history to ride a horse all the way around the biggest lake in the world, which is Lake Baikal in Siberia in Russia.
Yeah, I thought about that. I was thinking, but finding adventure in this world that gets smaller and smaller and more
gets
and more
harder every day,
it's a lot harder to find those adventures,
Well,
but he certainly has been brilliant at finding them, I'm sure, with your help, too.
Yes, he's been too good at it. in fact, Walter Cronkite wrote a lovely comment on my son's first book, which was about his expedition around Lake Baikal. Cronkite said just what you said. He said that at a time when people say that young people no longer have the spirit of adventure, it is refreshing to see that some young men still do. And, I could never get Walter Cronkite to write a comment for me in my book, Jack, but he got that when he was about 25.
Oh, that's great.
And then he also had one by Sir Edmund Hillary on his book jacket, who was at that time was the president of the Explorers Club.
Well, do us a favor. Put in a good word about Like Mother, Like Son, and maybe we can get your son to call in.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Well, there are a couple of other things you've done for a while. You had Firehouse Magazine that you did you buy it or establish it?
No, I founded it
with
a partner, yeah.
Right, and you've also been a great conservationist and supporter of environmental issues in New York.
Oh, well, I think there's no bigger issue in the world, and I think, by the way, that Mr. John Adams is one of the greatest Americans of his generation for all the work he's done.
Well, thank you. I think so, too, Bartle.
That
I
would
really
be my mother's husband.
well, it's been great to talk to you, and you know, I think I read somewhere somebody said, well, Bartle grew up in Lost New York and things have really changed. And we were just talking about the world being paved over and that kind of thing. But now working with Mark and Ramsey and meeting other people in their generation that are actually here in New York.
Yes.
Do you think New York has really changed that much since, let's say, the 60s?
I think it has changed
the youth scene.
I think, for example, although it's always been commercial, it's never been as hideously materialistic as it is today, it seems to me. And certainly there's less in the way of courtesy and manners, you know, just in the way people drive and walk on the sidewalk. But on the other hand, it has always maintained one thing, which is New York is still the most dynamic city in the world. It's not as crowded as, say, Hong Kong, but it's the most energetic in many ways, and the most diverse today. It's astonishing how every year there are, you know, more nationalities here with some significant influence or region of the city.
Right.
And I think the city, and I give Giuliani quite a lot of credit for that, because it was in, you know, we all know that New York was considered to be in hopeless decline.
That's really true, yeah.
Like him or not, the fact is that everybody we knew thought that New York City was in permanent decline. You know, we had 1,000,001 people on welfare out of 7 million. And now, you know, when he left, there were 518,000 and many more employed. So I think the city is still dynamic, but I think it's too materialistic. I do appreciate its the richness, you know, all the food you can get everywhere and it's stimulating. But it's a hard, tough place, though.
So I got a couple of just yes-no kind of questions. Mac or a PC?
PC, but I prefer Mac.
Digital camera or film?
Film.
Those are the two. It tells us a lot. I'm not sure what, but it tells us a lot.
It tells you I'm retrograde. It's backwards.
Well, Bartle, it's been great to talk to you today.
And I've enjoyed the show very much.
It's been a lot of fun. So glad that you were able to join us and fill us in. And you've just finished China Star, so I don't know if you're already started on another novel, but no.
Yes, I am, but I can't talk about it yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, also, just tell us, our audience and me too, do you have a website? Is that a way to find you other than Amazon? And
I don't have a website, but you can Google me. My son has a website, which is, I think it's Bartle Bull, I think it's www.bartlebull.com, and he generously lists my books on his website with all of his about 30 articles on Iraq.
Great. Well, that's Bartle,
and then Bull.
Bartle Bull. Yep. Bartle, thank you so much.
Amazon helps too. But thank you both so much.
Okay, Bartle, great to talk to you.
Bye bye.
Good night.
Bye bye.
Visit us online at www.likemotherlikeson.org and let us know what you think of the show.
Good night.